Welcome everyone to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. All right, we are in paper 52, section 2, which is old single column, page 591. All right, so remember that, and we just got rolling here on the Planetary Mortal Epics. We had that first section, you know, which is technically pre-Planetary Prince Man. But remember, they titled it Primitive Man because they wanted to, you know, to stress that element though. It might be a short period of time, you know, unlike on our world, it was 500,000 years. But, you know, that initial time before the Planetary Prince, everything is still, to a large degree, in the mode on the planet that it had been since life implantation. The adjutants are, you know, change their mode of function once you have will creatures. But in general, you have kind of still a very rough sort of environment. But when the Planetary Prince arrives, things start to kind of get plugged in to the universe circuits. And we're not just talking, you know, communication circuits, all of the things they don't really tell us about. And I was alluding to that last time. I mean, you start to have really a kind of a whole different environment energetically, matter, mind, and spirit, on a world once you've got the Planetary Prince in play. And then each new dispensation, like we said before, that environment is definitively altered. And it's just, that's the whole environment that we're immersed in, that we're completely ignorant of, you know, plays a significant role in how well we can function as humans. You know, your animal origin, you're basically just coming from the bottom up. You've got the adjutants, okay. But, you know, it's fairly individualized, self-contained. But once you start to function as a human, you're connecting into the cosmos. You're connecting into the universal harmony, at least potentially. That's what you're striving to do. You know, that universal harmony, that's not just, you know, a notion, you know, just a abstract concept. I mean, you're talking a literal phenomenon. There is a triunity. There is a harmony of energy that, you know, is ubiquitous in the cosmos, and that starts to really focus down and become more intimately present on a world. It's not unlike the creative mother spirit herself in a local universe, and how she comes down more and more present within the whole. You have these local focalizations of that same increasing presence of the womb of the mother that we're immersed in. Okay, so besides taking the next step to Planetary Prince arriving, so you're in the quote-unquote post-Planetary Prince Man stage, one could kind of tongue-in-cheek also think about this section as the post-political correctness man section, because this section ends with a pretty double-barreled challenge to mankind in terms of genetic issues, you know, which is all very politically incorrect to talk about, you know, in this age. So I alluded to that last time. So we'll be getting to that in the last part of this section. But to start off, it's a little bit more directly about about what this transition is about as you go from that first dispensation to this one.
Okay.
Section 2, Post-Planetary Prince Man. With the arrival of the Planetary Prince, a new dispensation begins. Government appears on Earth, and the advanced tribal epoch is attained. Great social strides are made during a few thousand years of this regime. Under normal conditions, mortals attain a high state of civilization during this age. They do not struggle so long in barbarism as did the Urantia races. But life on an inhabited world is so changed by rebellion that you can have little or no idea of such a regime on a normal planet.
Okay, now let's just look at that last sentence first. You know, that should strike you. You know, you're thinking, okay, our planetary prince arrived 500,000 years ago, right after quote-unquote primitive man. It's got to be pretty primitive sort of thing, even, you know, for that whole range. I must be able to kind of imagine that. No. That between the lines, what's that telling you? That in many ways, we're still way back, you know, trying to transition from primitive man into something a little more human. I mean, for them to say little or no idea, okay, of just what that first active ministry produces on a world. Now, that's that first comment there about great social strides are made during the a few thousand years of this regime. Remember that fundamentally the planetary prince, like we talked about, you know, a couple papers back, is the civilizational uplifter. And you know, you see that you know, under normal conditions, mortals attain a high state of civilization during this age. Okay. But that initial impact, even though you're not going to get very profound civilization per se going right away, during a few thousand years, you make a big impact on the social nature. Okay. This distinction is something you get into more when you go through the civilization papers, you know, later in the book. But you've got social, cultural, civilizational, in that order, in increasing sophistication. If you can tell, they're using them in a very specific sense in that passage, and they hear, you know, it doesn't say great civilizational strides are made, because they aren't. But that very rudimentary beginning aspect of associativity, just merely social, in other words, just the influence of the prince and his staff on getting humans to follow the impulse of their fifth adjutant, right, the social impulse, and what immediately stems from following that impulse, that can happen relatively quickly. Doesn't take 500,000 years or something, right? So that rudimentary, you know, fancy animal phenomenon starts to really get going, get some significant fifth adjutant association happening, and you'll begin to move, bring in some sixth adjutant, so that you have not just society but culture, you know, and we use the word, you know, cult, right, you know, as well as culture, right. You're getting some religious impulse energy, so it's a more sophisticated phenomenon when you're bringing in the sixth adjutant, you know, and then you're going to attempt to really get a personal phenomenon going, a civilization. Okay, but that's going to take a long time, especially when the mortals are so at beginning stages. And like they said, especially for us, where the prince, you know, even if the prince hadn't rebelled, he was still looking at a much more complicated project than the run-of-the-mill planetary prince, because he has to work with all of the Andonites that kind of in and of themselves are not really civilizable. Right? I mean, that's why he didn't come, you know, immediately. So he waited for 500,000 years until you had the Sangiks, you know, which are more immediately civilizable, at least, you know, in a rudimentary way. So you can, you know, you can wonder exactly what the plans were there. Obviously, having the staff be based upon Andonite stock rather than Sangik stock would be an inspiration for the Andonites. But, you know, you got to wonder if, you know, really kind of the plan for them is to really get them blended in, because, you know, in, like I just said, you know, innately they're kind of limited, right? I mean, a rudimentary Andonite really can't even consciousize grandchildren, right? They get children, but it's too sophisticated a concept to go to grandchildren for them, you know, so that's a fairly limited individual. Right? Now, you had something?
Weren't some of the Andonites, some of the latter Andonites, more civilized than certainly some of the other ones that became more mixed?
Well, I mean, yeah, I was just going to mention that. I mean, you have, you know, you have some cream of the crop with the Andonites, but there's an awful lot of backmating, remember, you know, so that just, you know, that just further exacerbates the problem. I mean, pure line Andonites would have been difficult enough for the prince's staff, but when you got all of this backmated stock, you know, so it's very limited. You know, you got all, you know, a lot of issues for him. But, you know, remember that was kind of the whole point. You know, our planetary prince, it was really intrigued by the challenge of, you know, of all this. Doing something that, you know, normally doesn't have to be done and coming up with clever, creative ways to manage that. Too bad he didn't, you know, keep his eyes pointed at the horizon instead of at his belly button. And just that long struggle in barbarism, you know, again, remember, a lot of that is exacerbated by all the backmated stock. Let's see. All right. So, let's see what else they got here then.
The average length of this dispensation is around 500,000 years, some longer, some shorter. During this era, the planet is established in the circuits of the system, and a full quota of seraphic and other celestial helpers is assigned to its administration. The thought adjusters come in increasing numbers, and the seraphic guardians amplify their regime of mortal supervision.
Okay, so, you know, you're initially struck that that the average is around 500,000 years. It isn't just us, you know, but remember what we read in the first section, you know, that that process of getting all six Sangiks in existence could be spread out over a very long span of time. You know, so that, you know, that's just one simple factor that is always going to make this dispensation, you know, a fairly extended phenomenon. Right? That, you know, the planetary prince may be coming and there's, you know, only say two of the six Sangiks in existence yet or something. Right? So, right. So just, you know, obviously is going to extend until you've got the basic system going that he can start to manage. So it's always going to be a pretty long span of time. You know, remember they said to get all the Sangiks was a minimum of 150,000 years and sometimes over a million years. You know, so when they say some longer, some shorter, you know, longer might be a lot longer. Right? I mean, so there's that. And then notice what I was alluding to at the beginning, that second sentence. During this era, the planet is established in the circuits of the system. Right? This whole never fully explained by the revelators, phenomenon of kind of plugging the planet into things and establishing, you know, an environment. Remember, they don't even talk about the spirit controller beings. You know, they mention them a couple times, right, in passing. But this whole bit of a spirit energy environment that is controlled to the same, with the same complexity, you know, and to the same degree as physical energy with all the master physical controllers, right? I mean, all of that is being, you know, started up, and so we don't really know the specifics, but it's, you can see it's having a significant impact. This new environment that everyone is immersed in now allows a lot more individuals to either get an adjuster as a spirit fuser, because remember before this, basically all spirit fusers. So a little bit more individuals to reach that, and obviously also more that can be father fusers. Okay, so really, you know, a significant number of father fusers is now kicking in post-planetary prints. Yeah, and you see that, you know, when they say that the thought adjusters come in increasing numbers and the Seraphic Guardians amplify their regime of mortal supervision. Right? That, you know, you've got to remember that in that pre-planetary prints time, there's going to be a lot of individuals that are human, they're fully human, but they don't get an adjuster, right? Primitive mortals, in many ways, are kind of just the supreme evolving. They're not really definitively individuated from the supreme, right? You don't even have the chance of individuating from the supreme if you don't get an adjuster, right? And so prior to that, there would be a lot of, you know, all seven adjutants and circuited in the Holy Spirit, personality, you know, engaged from the Father, all of that. They're fully human, but they don't get an adjuster. So when they die, they just die, right? And that personality becomes part of God the Almighty, you know, evolving God the Almighty. Before I got one over here first.
Now Andon and Fanta did have adjusters. They fused.
Right. They were. Yes.
Was it because they were the first?
Yeah.
Was there something distinctly special about them that?
Yeah. The first pair. If I was in the webinar, he's bringing up Andon and Fanta, right? In our case, okay, our first humans are two Andonites, yeah, but they're exceptional. The first pair, you know, are definitively father fusers.
Oh, okay.
Okay. That initial pair stand as the archetypes, right, for all those that follow. The majority of those that follow are going to be spirit fusers, but it's very important to get it off to a solid start. You know, the first pair have thought adjusters, so that means when they have kids, those children can get adjusters automatically, you know, at roughly age six. But, you know, the moment you have a situation where, you know, your parents don't have adjusters, right, then you're under those prerequisites of adjuster indwelling things. I mean, you got to get it somehow on your own. Now, fortunately, in this early stage, you know, you don't have to try to somehow get yourself up to third circler or something like that, right? There's a lot of individuals, spirit fusers, that get adjusters for reasons even the revelators don't understand, right? You know, that's part of the supreme, basically fostering those individuals to separate from the supreme, right? I mean, it's like being pushed out of the womb, right? Sort of, right? I mean, technically we're talking about, you know, in terms of the Supreme, and we're not talking about the Supreme Being, we're talking about the Universal Mother. We're talking about, you know, that personal purposive aspect down in the finite, fostering evolution, you know, actively. You know, and there is a coalescence of greater integrity that none of the relatives understand the physics of, or even can really observe in any way, you know, but they know it's there because, ta-da, there's an adjuster that arrives for this individual. You know, it's just a temporary, you know, so that they can have a soul and be a spirit fuser, but still. So it's not as grim as you'd think, you know, primitives, and they all have to somehow get the third circlers, and so, wow, I mean, most of them are not going to make it. But still, you can tell by this, right, that there are still going to be a lot that just don't get adjusters. Okay.
You covered
it. I covered it? Okay. All right. Was there something?
I just forgot.
Okay. Yeah, so... right, so all those details you know, just recognizing that, you know, there's nothing magical in play. We're slowly coalescing. I mean, none of us, I mean, all of us are still technically drops of water in the ocean right now, right? You know, we could still melt back into the ocean of the Supreme. Right? Until you fuse with your thought adjuster, you haven't fully separated from the whole, you know, definitively individuated relative to eternity, right? You're individuated relative to time, right? The moment, but not relative to eternity. So, I mean, technically, you're still a drop of water in the ocean right now, right? Like we talk about, I mean, you know, you don't even get a name until you fuse with your adjuster because, you know, right now, technically, you're an unfertilized egg, right? And not even, you know, the me that's talking and thinking right now is not the unfertilized egg, it's my soul. You know, that mindful self that's seated on that soul that I'm not even conscious of, that's the unfertilized egg. Right, and it just has a number. You know, that's the me that's going on. Right, so, right now, it's, you know, it's all very tentative. You know, and an awful lot of those drops of water don't separate. You know, they're sort of just lumps in the Supreme, and they're just, they appear to be individuals, but they really aren't, right? They're really just the Supreme, you know, in a, some sort of a complex dance, you know, that in order for the Supreme to evolve, it has to appear to be an individual for a short period of time, and then, you know, then that melts away. It's a very complex process. All right, let's keep going here.
When the planetary prince arrives on a primitive world, the evolved religion of fear and ignorance prevails. The prince and the staff make the first revelations of higher truth and universe organization. These initial presentations of revealed religion are very simple, and they usually pertain to the affairs of the local system. Religion is wholly an evolutionary process prior to the arrival of the planetary prince. Subsequently, religion progresses by graduated revelation as well as by evolutionary growth. Each dispensation, each mortal epoch, receives an enlarged presentation of spiritual truth and religious ethics. The evolution of the religious capacity of receptivity in the inhabitants of a world largely determines their rate of spiritual advancement and the extent of religious revelation.
Why don't we take that last sentence first? You notice the word capacity, right? That whole bit of the mother is growing you, you know, as she's the one that has capacity that is being bequeathed to you, so that you can have more capacity. She's the reservoir of capacity that you're drawing from to acquire that capacity. And in a simple way, I mean, just literally think of it as the volume of the upper domain of the hourglass, in the hourglass analogy of your mindful self, right? And how large a capacity do you have up there in that upper domain? How much potential relationship to the cosmos do you have? How much potential to function as a person do you have? You know, a thimble full or a cup full, right? So that's you're just totally limited by that. I mean, you have to just supply the favorable conditions to be grown and wait to be grown. There's nothing you can, no amount of consecration of will increases your capacity one iota, right? It's that consecration of mind. It's that other consecration that's going to get you more capacity. And obviously at a very rudimentary stage, primitive stage like this, you know, there's not a lot of active individual consecration going on. It's all just kind of, they're being progressed in spite of themselves mostly, back then.
That's why those communion cups are so
tiny. Yeah, very good, yes. It matches, yes, the thimble of your mind, yes. Very little needs to be bathed. Now notice when they are using the words to encourage some recognition. You know, right before that last sentence there, when they notice how they use the adjective spiritual truth, but religious ethics. And, you know, basically, religious means personal spiritual, not merely spiritual. Now, obviously, you have to be a person to relate to truth at all. Okay, but why did they contrast that? You know, they're just trying to get you to reflect on that and recognize that initially to encourage personal actualization, personality actualization, an abstract thing like truth is not a very catalytic agent. But another individual, you know, ethics, right? Your duty to others, right? It's not going to be more abstract like duty to the cosmos, or it's not going to be moral duty, but that ethical duty, you know, you get that. I'm an individual, you know, you're an individual, and, you know, you begin to get some sense of duty in that relationship. You know, and they're just pointing out that, you know, is the spark for getting some actual personal nature going. You know, the challenge of trying to relate to another individual brings out personal more than, you know, a more generalized philosophic pursuit, right, of truth. But by grace, you've got this encirclement in the Holy Spirit, right? And so, you know, you have that spiritualized mind in the upper domain of the hourglass, right, so that you have a potential relationship to truth in that upper domain. So that's there, and the prince and his staff are encouraging, you know, a greater wholeness of function in that upper domain, and also personality engagement of what's there, you know, to take that actuality to a reality. Get some personality identification really going with its wholeness. And the interpersonal is the real initial catalyst for that. Let's see. What else do we have there? Remember how this pattern goes. So here's the first step. Once you've got the planetary prince, you start getting a revelation up the hierarchy. Step one, to really give you some sense of the local system, right? And initially, God is going to basically be the system sovereign, right? They're not going to try to give you some sort of a concept of some infinite universal father or something like that. I mean, it starts out by just really getting people to have sort of a local system, a very parochial, local sort of a concept, you know, and effectively God is the system sovereign, you know, and then we'll see in the next, you know, dispensation when you get to Adam and Eve, remember, it goes up to the constellation level, you know, and then God, quote unquote, right, is the Most High. Right, and that's why Machaventa, you know, referred to God that way. That's why even Jesus, you know, continued to refer to God that way. I mean, he didn't really, you know, even though he came as a bestowal son, he, in many ways, he kept things in the post-Adamic mode. Didn't really try to push things up to the next notch. like the magisterial son more definitively will. All right, so you've got that. That again just reminds you about how exceptional this book is that's sitting in my lap. Right? That we're a people in many ways to tell us beyond local system or constellation is too much for us. And what have they done? Right? We've got master architects and you name it. Right?
Beyond.
Right? They're challenging us to try to think about God the Supreme, God the Ultimate, God the Absolute, God the Sevenfold. I mean, all kinds of complexity. You shouldn't be surprised if an awful lot of people are not ready to assimilate the fifth epical revelation. I mean, really, all they're ready for is a quote-unquote God that's basically, an anthropomorphized, glorified system sovereign. Right? I mean, that's about as big a God as they could possibly even imagine, technically.
With a beard sitting up in there.
Right. Right. Again, that should remind you that this is not a dispensational revelation. Right? It's not meant for everyone. It's so sweeping, in many ways you think, well, is there anyone ready for it? Right? Are any of us ready to really go way beyond even what they're, what a normal bestowal son is teaching, or teacher sons are teaching in some ways, right? Remember, the details about the master architects aren't usually taught in a local universe until the local universe is settled in light and life, right? Which is crazy long time, in the future.
That makes us security breach risks.
Yeah. Right. So anyway, it's
stop there, Dick, for a second.
Yeah.
So what is it? Then what is it? Here again, if its purpose, as you say, mm-hmm. or if its abilities mm-hmm. is only for some,
right.
not for many, and even as you and I imagine you're inferring for quite a long time.
Yeah, at least until you get, say, a magisterial son.
Right. Right? So what do you see as the underlying, other than the emergency, mm-hmm. the underlying effect that mm-hmm. comes out of this right. book? Because, if it's not, how does the emergency get acted upon by, just a teeny right. number of people, so to speak, right. and really affect everybody?
Right, and the way
it
you...
It is a too big a question.
No, the way you know the answer to that question is... we've had another non-dispensational revelation.
Melchizedek?
Right, the third, okay. right, is an epical but non-dispensational one. So you've got an example, and they talk a lot about it. So, by analogy, you can figure out what's going on with this one. What did Machaventa do? He did two things. One, he tried to foster the main evolutionary stream to keep a minimum integrity, sort of a post-Adamic integrity until Michael arrived,
okay.
right? And he did that through Abraham, right? Abraham is basically just, Melchizedek trying to keep the post-Adamic phenomenon going.
And about all those, teachers that he taught.
Right, we're getting that. Okay. The primary reason that that what he's doing is an epical revelation. I mean, because think about it. I mean, the Melchizedeks, just all 12 of them, behind the scenes, were trying to keep the post-Adamic thing going.
Right.
Right. The thing that really makes it not just run-of-the-mill fostering of the evolutionary process, but an epical revelation is the other thing that Machaventa did, the non-Abraham thing that he did. He worked with the Kenites.
Yeah.
What he did is he established a parallel stream to the main evolutionary stream. A parallel stream of people that he taught at a much deeper level, got them to have some rudimentary cosmic consciousness, got them coordinated with the cosmos a bit, got them to have some philosophic consciousness. And so you establish that parallel little stream. And out of that little parallel stream, leaders can step out of that into the main evolutionary stream, like Moses. Right? Moses comes out of that parallel stream that Machaventa set up and steps into the main evolutionary stream and leads it. Right? The main purpose of this revelation as an epical revelation is to foster that parallel leadership potential stream. There's never been more than 1% in any generation.
Which is a lot, though.
Right, which is a lot, right? Right, but, you know, the whole point is that we don't have leaders with enough of a philosophic framework and with enough cosmic consciousness to properly lead. You don't have to have everyone, you know, challenge themselves to true philosophy. It's not required. But there, you have to have at least a little subset of leaders, right? That's the main point. To give us the big picture perspective so that it can be recognized by that handful of people that have the capacity. Most on the planet don't have the capacity. You know, and if they have the capacity to recognize that, that means they also have the capacity to be a leader. And they don't all have to lead. Not everyone in the Kenite stream led. But when a leader, a definitive leader like Moses was needed, you know, that's where he comes from. He can't come from anywhere else. Right? Only that deeper teaching produced the big picture consciousness that Moses had, where he could take the ragtag bunch and, you know, and lead them forward. All right, so that the main purpose, it's not meant to be universalized. It's meant to seek out those who are ready to take on the big picture. There's no salvation requirement, you know, we all know, or anything like that. So, you know, no one needs it as an individual. Right? There's not a spiritual emergency. No individuals, quote unquote, need this. There's a civilizational emergency because there aren't appropriate leaders. Right? Leaders are needed, and leaders need to be taught. Normally, leaders are taught by the prince and his staff, and Adam and Eve, and right? That's how there's leaders on a world. Someone has to teach them. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, we all know that's the whole point. You bring people in that are potential leaders to train them up and send them out as leaders.
Yeah. Well, yeah. You have periodic revelations of God that are on a hierarchy.
Right,
scale.
Moving up, right.
That doesn't mean that on the first level that is merely emotionalism. And there's something about emotionalism that passes for religion today that doesn't have any bearing to what concept of God they have.
Right, and you see that even though it's a very limited concept they're giving him, it's true nonetheless. They're trying to take them from just, you know, emotionalism, say, as a primitive animal origin creature, to something that in a thin little thread way embodies spiritual truth.
Okay, yeah.
It's small, but it's whole. There's a truth to it, no matter how small. Right? And that takes great creativity and skill on the part of the prince's staff to know how to keep it very downstepped, very simple, and yet still whole-like. True, still true. Okay. Yeah. All right.
This dispensation witnesses a spiritual dawn, and the different races and their various tribes tend to develop specialized systems of religious and philosophic thought. They're uniformly run through all of these racial religions, two strains. The early fears of primitive men and the later revelations of the planetary prince. In some respects, your ancients do not seem to have wholly emerged from this stage of planetary evolution. As you pursue this study, you will more clearly discern how far your world departs from the average course of evolutionary progress and development.
Okay, so see that very first statement. This dispensation witnesses a spiritual dawn. Again, remember, we're not talking...
That's talking about the planetary prince.
The planetary prince. Right? Remember, challenge yourself to think of the word spirit literally. Not like every human has ever used that word and thought about that word. Right? It has nothing to do with a feeling. It has nothing to do with emotionalism, for instance. It's a substance in the external world. Like I said, there is now a greater spirit substance, spirit energy in the external world on this planet. And they're fostering an association with that. Right? You have material stimulus inputs that you all know about, but you also have spirit energy stimulus inputs. A spiritual dawn, light shines on that spirit substance and you quote-unquote see it. And, you get a stimulus input into your mind because that spirit in the external world is illuminated. Just like having the lights on in this room, so the matter in this room is illuminated. And I get some stimulus in my mind relative to it. Right? It isn't just a black void. That's what they're talking about. You think about this literally, right? That they're trying to encourage that spirit stimulus of the mind, the mindal selves. Right? And once you have that spiritual stimulus, no matter how primitive the notions are that people have religiously and philosophically, like they're saying here, right? You have something that has some genuineness of religious and philosophic nature. Right? Because religion doesn't have any genuineness that's related to matter. Right? And that's one of the reasons why basically all the religion on this planet is religion so-called. Right? It fixates on matter. Right? Religion is about the other substance, the substance you can't see in the external world. That's what they mean by the religion of the spirit. Right? If you still think that religion is about relating to something in the inner life, you don't understand what religion is. Right? Religion is about relating to the other substance in the external world, like science is relating to the material substance in the external world. Religion is relating to spirit substance in the external world. That's a religion of the spirit. And if you aren't challenging yourself to somehow understand what that very abstract thought, right? You still have a religion of the mind, and you basically have a religion of meism, right? Because that's the only mind you're associated with, is your mindal self, right? I mean, it's just going to be about you. You've got to get it objectified. You've got to get it related to the objective domain, the external world, so it isn't just a glorified youism, your religion. And so that they're fostering that right away, trying to get that light shined upon that other substance, the external world.
Chris,
yep.
Isn't it inner and outer thing? I mean,
science is inner, too, right? Because I actually can't see this material substance. I actually can't touch this material substance. All I can see and touch is the representations of that material substance in my mind. Right? Same way with spirit. Remember, there's a passage in the book that reminds you of that. I mean, everything has to get into the mind. But just because spirit stimulus comes into the mind, don't assume that it's in the mind as a source.
But what about the source of the thought adjuster is also a stimulus?
Right.
So that's what
right.
I'm saying.
But as a spirit stimulus, it's not mind. Right? The only way you can become aware of the adjuster is to for there to be a representation put in your mind.
Yeah.
Right? You can't touch or see an adjuster, you know, directly. You know, all you and religionists have always assumed that the appearance is the reality. That the appearance of that spiritual stimulus in your mind is the reality of it. No, the reality is in the external world. It's not inside. And if you don't remind yourself of that, it's always going to lead to a more and more delusional consciousness and eventually a self-righteous consciousness. Right? I mean, if you think that you are spirit, rather than spirit being a substance in the external world that you're trying to somehow get into relationship with, right, it's going to lead to a self-aggrandizement. That's where self-righteousness comes from, right? And the fact that you've got this spirit influence that literally is within your mind makes the potential for self-righteousness all the greater. Because it will even more appear that the spirit is inside because of that, you know. But just remember the influence is inside, but as a spirit fragment, it isn't it's not technically in the mind.
I guess it's spirit. About the influence.
Right. Yeah. So that but just remember that's the thing. You know, you have a representation in the mind. That's the influence.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's say the Holy Spirit or the Spirit of Truth ministries, those are spirit ministries, those are outside of the mindal self, but they stimulate the mindal self. There's an influence in your mind from them. There's a representation of them in your mind. And that's subject to all the relativity of how well your mind can represent objective facts. Okay? There's no mystical faculty that allows you to have spirit phenomena properly represented.
Mm-hmm.
Right? The representation is subject to the same limitations as me seeing, you know, anything in this room. Right? If I'm colorblind, I don't see the colors in this room very well. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Spirit stimuli are subject to the same things. Right? But humans have never believed that. Humans have always believed, you know, they recognized a long time ago that you've got all these issues of, you know, things not being as they appear in terms of material things. But they've always assumed that spirit things are exactly as they appear because they're not limited by the same representation issues that matter is. You know, the revelation says, no. I mean, matter of fact, that's the most problematic assumption you can make. Is that you have somehow some mystical faculty that gives you absolute representations, you know, in your mind of spirit influences.
I've never gone that far with
that. But a lot of people have, right? I mean, you know.
I just think it's an influence.
Yeah, right, so you got to remember that you're seeing through a glass darkly, always, right? It's not really as it appears, ever. You know, your most sublime experience of the Universal Father is not an experience of the reality of the Universal Father. It's an experience of an appearance. The appearance of a representation in your mind. You know, and as they're just pointing out, if you have very limited capacity for receptivity, right, you've taken some wonderful objective fact and crammed it into a tiny little space. Right? If I take if I take the canvas of the Last Supper, gigantic canvas, and I wad it up and shove it into a thimble, and then look at it inside of the thimble, will I see the beauty of that painting? No. That's what it's like. You know, remember, that's why they talk about the adjuster being imprisoned in your mind, right? You've taken this fragment of infinity and you've crumpled it up into a grotesque little glob and crammed it into your mind in terms of what you can experience. It's very difficult for it to represent anything in such a tiny, crumpled space. And we have to be humble and remind ourselves of that, and don't think that somehow we get some experience and we've just seen the reality of it, you know, or something, or felt the reality of it. You know, remember, that's why the revelers say, it is always better to reject such an experience than it is to believe it. You know, it's better to reject a real message from the adjuster, right? You know, that because it's so easy for it to appear that you've gotten from the adjuster and you haven't. And even if you have gotten something from the adjuster, it's gotten garbled. It's better to just forget about it, because you don't have to be conscious of anything from the adjuster right now.
I'm not.
Yeah. That's why they say, leave everything beyond the dead level of the conscious, you know, to the powers that be. You get my point. All right, so now what else do we have here? We got these important things in here. So we got the spiritual dawn, and then this is a very important point that they make in the middle of that paragraph. They're uniformly run through all these racial religions, two strains, and reflect on what they have, you know, for the two strains there. One is the early fears of primitive men. Okay, the other, the later religions, okay, later revelations. Okay, we got the basic of that. But the early fears of primitive men. Do you have fears? If you do, it's because you're primitive. Primitive men have fears. Remember how they're just reminding you that you really can't even imagine a post-planetary prince sort of thinking, is you're basically still in the primitive man stage. Right? That's why Jesus said, fear not. And what he's saying when he says fear not is, okay, step one, you can't be primitive. If you're still primitive, I mean, you're not gonna get anything from me. I'm trying to give you something. And if you have any primitive nature, like fear, whatever I give you, you will just totally twist up. If your mind is still capable of fear, your mind is not capable of receiving what I have to give you. You know, especially, you know, in any conscious way. Now, I mean, the good news is what I was just saying a minute ago. I mean, we don't have to receive anything consciously. Those influences are working super consciously, away from our muddling, you know, like away from our fear, you know, and there's a space that's fear-free enough that the adjuster can be there, and the adjuster can make your embryonic soul and all that. You know, so that's taken care of. You're going to survive this life. You have a soul. For you to get consciously involved in any of this, if step one hasn't been completed, fear not, you can't go there. You're still a primitive human. You know, so you know, think about that. I mean, that they're basically, you know, a planetary prince, by the time he's done, you basically don't have any fear in those humans anymore. Especially by the time you're done with the Adam and Eve, there's no fear on that planet. Right? That should just, like, really, you know, remind you of what a difficult task is, you know, is in front of us. Because I certainly still struggle with fears. You know, when we say, don't we all?
Right.
Look at what they're saying here. It's like, no, not in a normal world. that fierce animal fear stuff is left behind really early on. A magisterial,
innate fear.
Yeah, that animal innate fear stuff. I mean, the magisterial son and the bestowal son come to a world where there isn't fear and minister to worlds without fear.
No wonder we have an emergency revelation.
Okay. Yep.
It's talking about the religion of fear. Are mm-hmm. they, the way I read that is that they're looking more at the, like, fear of lightning or fear of volcanoes or, you know, all that, things that they couldn't understand.
Right. Almost, you know, every religion on this planet is fixated on a big concept called salvation. Why do religions worry about salvation? Is that not because of fear? And then it's not volcano fear or hurricane fear, right? It's fear, right? It's all consuming fear. I mean, religions are all about you and your fears, you and your salvation, and you know, and prayers, and I mean, that's all religions are about, is assuaging fears. Right? So they're primitive religions. Now, what would a religion look like where none of the participants have any fear? That would be the religion of Jesus, right? But religions about Jesus can have bucket loads of fear, you know. And just because you have a fancier religion about Jesus, you know, doesn't change anything. Right? You still have this basically primitive fear-based religion, and it's just fear of everything. You know, fear of, you know, your children dying, or I mean, you just have all these fears, right? Fear that you won't be able to make your mortgage payment this month, or, you know, whatever the heck it is. Just endless fears. Fears about everything.
You think primitive men even had salvation fear? I don't even think about that.
No, I mean, initially, no. Right? Until you got the revelation of going on to a next life, no one had salvation fears, right? So the planetary prince, you know, juices up some new potential fears that then have to be overcome. Right? It's just, this is, you know, this is, a, you know, they're trying to get us to recognize just how far behind we are in this process. What it means to be doing advanced technology in people that still have fear, right? Adam and Eve normally give advanced technology to people where fear is fading away.
It's made it more complicated and horrifying in a way.
Right? If I'm afraid and I have weapons of mass destruction, problematic things happen, right? But if I'm not afraid, you know, it's a very different situation. If I'm not afraid of what that person over there might do to me. Okay. All right. So, yeah, and that's why I say, you know, in some respects, your ancients do not seem to have wholly emerged. Right? I mean, you know, the fear thing is the really biggie there, right? I mean, yeah, we've got you know, post and you know, the three centuries of the Enlightenment, we've got some of the technology that Adam and Eve would normally be giving, right? We're not back in, you know, in post-planetary prince man in that regard, but the fear thing is the biggie. I mean, that's just a simple litmus test about where you are in this process. All right. Show me a world without fear, and then I'll show you a world that's making some progress. Okay, you're certainly never going to have, you know, peace on earth and goodwill among men if everyone hasn't done the first step of fear not.
I think you've answered this, but Winston's using the word emotionalism. So he's saying, do you feel that if we as a people, or I as an individual, use less emotionalism, that our maturing will be strengthened and more simple and whole-like.
Yeah, I mean, definitely. I mean, you know, these summer presentations we do, you know, help to go through some of these issues. But there's so many things that people think religion isn't, it is that it isn't. And one of the initial challenges you have is to recognize, no, that's not religion. No, that's not religion. No, that's not religion. And then you should get to the point where you go, okay, well, now I have nothing left. So what is religion? Right? Yeah, you've got the blank slate. Right? You've got to get to the point where you got to stop being satisfied with something that you think is religion and isn't. Right? Just like you got to stop calling all the various things of self personality. Right? Same thing. You know, eventually you go, it's not this. And okay, I've got nothing left. Yeah, okay, now let's try to figure out what personality is. Until you take everything off the table that it isn't, right, you're not going to figure out what it is. You're not going to figure out what worship is. Until you take everything off the table that you think is worship that isn't, only then do you have the potential of finding genuine worship. Because everything you have on the table that you're calling worship is reverence. That's not worship. That's four levels below worship. Right? Okay.
Close to awe and dread, isn't it?
Yes. Right. It's right there next to awe, yes. The reverence of unity is not worship. Not worship of God. Okay. Let's see, what else do we have there? Just one passing comment. Isn't that kind of interesting that they... it's not very often that they do what they do in that last sentence there. As you pursue this study... You know, they don't often talk to you like that. Yeah.
It made me want to study deeper.
Yeah.
Yeah. Summer courses.
But just notice, as they're saying, if you are genuinely studying, one of the very, very straightforward things that it will begin to dawn in your mind, if there's any genuineness to your study, is just what I was just talking about. How far removed you are in terms of your ideas from what the revelators are talking about. You know, what they mean by the word personality, what they mean by the word spirit, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. What they mean by the word truth or, you know, any other significant thing. And Oh, question over here? Oh, okay. See, they're just trying, you know, notice that that's a very simple thing that they're saying, that you can, some feedback that you can get that you're on the right path. You know, when you start to recognize just how far you are from where they want you to be. Right? That's not a new thing. Reflective thinkers for the last 2,600 years figured that out. Right? That's that whole Cartesian doubt thing, that's that whole blank slate thing, right? Humans have figured this out, and they're just reminding you that you've got to initially bring in this universal humility and just let go of all the things that you think you know exactly what that's about, right? And be willing to be revealed to, you know, to be willing to be told, no, little child, it's not that. But if you are sincere and earnest, right, and patient, you can get there. You can begin to have a real relationship with some of these things. All right.
But the planetary prince is not the prince of peace. Racial struggles and tribal wars continue over into this dispensation, but with diminishing frequency and severity. This is the great age of racial dispersion, and it culminates in a period of intense nationalism. Color is the basis of tribal and national groupings, and the different races often develop separate languages. Each expanding group of mortals tends to seek isolation. This segregation is favored by the existence of many languages. Before the unification of the several races, their relentless warfare sometimes results in the obliteration of whole peoples. The orange and green men are particularly subject to such extinction.
Okay, remember we talked about that before, the why, you know, why orange and green? Yeah, so, but they're just reminding us of that fact again. And, you know, fundamentally, you know, the reason, remember, is which adjutant they favor. Favoring those non-grounded in the moment adjutants of the second and the third adjutants, or respectively the third and second adjutants, orange and green, you know, just makes them very, very limited, very, you know, very subject to
vulnerable.
To being overcome, right? Right, they're very vulnerable, right? I mean, because they're so in the moment and so not grounded. You know, like, you know, even though Indigo Man is in the moment, at least he's grounded in the first adjutant, you know, being the one he favors. But that they're throwing that in again because they're reminding you that, you know, fundamentally, they're trying to foster this improved mind activity. Right, and so they're reminding you that, you know, these issues of mind are very, very rudimentarily in play, and you're working on just these very straightforward things, you know. And why is color the basis of tribal and national groupings? It's not because they're immediately fixated on color. You know, the reason we fixate on color is because behind the color is a bias of mind. You know, and you know, this person of a different color thinks differently than you, and you know, that's the way foreigners are. They think funny, right?
It's just black and white.
Right? You just.
I'm fearful.
It's just the fact that they think differently. So that's fundamentally why color becomes this discriminator, right? is because of the mind differences behind the color. Okay, so the prince is trying to work with all these different mindal issues, and remember how they mentioned up there at the beginning, an advanced tribal epic is attained here in this. So, and see that they're reminding you here again. So we've got kind of the naturalness of clans and tribes, and the prince is working in that naturalness. But trying to get, by the end of his dispensation, well, you know, the post-planetary prince man dispensation, to get it to the point where it begins to become artificial. It begins to become more of a civilization phenomenon instead of just merely a natural phenomenon. To go from tribe to nation. Right? With tribe, you've got folkways, and that's all just pretty natural, the way adjutant mind attunes to genetics. To go from folkways to mores, to go from tribe to nation, is to really begin to apply personal creativity, to take what we are naturally and reform it. Right? Art, you know, that which is art-like, artificial, is you take what's there naturally and you creatively reform it, make it what it isn't naturally. You reform it upward from what it is naturally. That's what you're doing within your mind when you apply your personality to your mind. You're reforming. You're changing it from what it is naturally. You're making it an art form. And it's an art form that's oriented upward. And as each individual does that inside, you socialize that to the outer life. And you can begin to go beyond the mere naturalness of folkways to this consciously chosen, reflectively recognized mores system, right? That you all choose to live under. Right? You know, everyone naturally lives under folkways, right? But you choose to live under a more. And And when you do that, when you have that greater phenomenon that is transcendent of just the racial genetic sorts of things, individuality, so you can go to a bigger group. You can transcend tribe and go to a nation. All right, so that's the prince is trying to get things up to the level of nation status to hand off to Adam and Eve. Right? So Adam and Eve normally begin with a significant nation phenomenon and try to work from there. You know, but of course our Adam and Eve, right, just had total chaos. Right? So again, I mean, you know, Adam and Eve aren't used to starting at such a rudimentary level. They're used to working on the shoulders of giants, you know, as it were. Right? 500,000 years, say, of getting it really out of the tribal stage and at the beginnings of nation stage. So, for instance, angels of nation life have something to do, sure. Right? Angels of nation life don't do anything with tribes and clans. Right? all right. You know, remember, Master Seraphim come with the planetary prince, remember? So, you know, they don't mention that here, but those are all those Master Seraphim are in play here behind the scenes with the prince and his staff, too. Okay, let's see. What else do we have there? Again, the whole bit of languages, you know, the fact that they say they often develop separate languages. Right? The only reason they wouldn't develop a separate language is if that racial stock is really being forced to use the language of someone else. Naturally, because of the different way they use adjective mind, their biases, they're just going to naturally have a different language. The adjective mind is attuned to their genetics. Okay. All right, yeah, let's keep going.
On average worlds, during the latter part of the prince's rule, national life begins to replace tribal organization, or rather to be superimposed upon the existing tribal groupings. But the great social achievement of the prince's epic is the emergence of family life. Heretofore, human relationships have been chiefly tribal. Now the home begins to materialize.
And so, and besides just the biologic thing, see again, notice how they say the home. Okay? Yeah. They obviously mean more than just pair mating, right? What happens naturally. Right, see, so the more that you can have a personal phenomenon that can exist as a nation in the outer life, as a whole, right? You begin to have, a growing equality between the sexes and a more and more genuine home phenomenon developing, rather than just matter of fact procreation.
Small wonder we have such an emergency situation here when you look at the condition of the family in our civilization. What's happening to it? It's disintegrating before our very eyes.
Right. And the very fact that the home is disintegrating is why you should put quotes around civilization, you know, when you say our civilization. And the disintegration of the home is a sure sign that, you know, that there's a civilizational emergency. Right? It's like we're seeing with this initial civilizational uplifter, to go from just social influence, like I mentioned at the beginning, to genuine civilizational influence at the end of this dispensation, it requires genuine families, you know, as the nuclei for everything civilizational. Right? All human institutions of civilization are predicated on the family and the home. Yeah. So you got to go beyond just functioning like a pack of animals procreating. Right? Let's see. So they're just, you know, that's, again, see, it's like I said, it just goes hand in hand with it, getting from tribe to nation. Okay?
This is the dispensation of the realization of sex equality. On some planets, the male may rule the female. On others, the reverse prevails. During this age, normal worlds establish full equality of the sexes, this being preliminary to the fuller realization of the ideals of home life. This is the dawn of the golden age of the home. The idea of tribal rule gradually gives way to the dual concept of national life and family life.
And again,
it's the planetary prince.
Right. And normally, that's established, see, by the planetary prince.
Yeah,
it sucks. Right. We have this delusional notion of equality that we're trying to impose upon ourselves, right? The mindal selves are not equal. You know, never, ever will a female mindal self be equal to a male mindal self. They're fundamentally different, right? Deep, deep enlightened life, female and male mindal selves are different. What's equal between males and females? Personality, right? There aren't male and female personalities, right? There's only one type of personality that we're getting, creature personality from the father, right? It's like we're saying, that you're trying to get a more human, personal, reformed phenomenon happening. The more a male and a female are a personal phenomenon, the more they are naturally equal, because persons are, you know, have the equality of that spirit. Right? Equality is a spirit word. It's not a mindal or material word. And so it's obvious, it's going to go hand in hand again. You're getting this more definitive, obviously relative to light and life is still rudimentary, but definitive personal phenomenon happening through the influence of the planetary prince. You have a civilization that's chosen by persons. You've got nations, not just tribes. And you've got men and women as persons procreating and raising children, rather than fancy animals procreating and raising children. Yeah. That's the job of the planetary prince. And, you know, we obviously, you know, haven't even gotten, you know, to this. I mean, we have this notion of equality, but we're trying to delusionally actualize it with mindal selves, you know, and of course it doesn't happen naturally, so more and more we're like, well, we have to force mindal selves to be the same, you know, or let's pretend that male and female mindal selves are the same, and it's all these ridiculous things that we're doing right now, right? And you need to go up to find the equality. It's not down there in the material mind plane. You know, get up there to the spirit and you can have ideals of home life instead of just ideas of home life. Right? Until there's actual spirit, that other substance in the external world, right, there aren't ideals. Right? And the fact that humans don't know about that other substance, don't try to identify with that other substance. They try to make the one substance they know about matter be everything. We don't have genuine idealism. We don't have spiritual idealism. We have material idealism. We have false idealism. You know, and we have so-called ideals of home life or family life, but they're all false because they're material, you know, in conception. They're not predicated on the unity substance. So all these challenges, this is what we've got to work on, looking up for ideals.
Why shouldn't we seek for life on the dead level?
Yeah, maybe because it's dead. Maybe this distinction is vital, right? You want to be living, right? All right, what else happens in this sort of, you can see they're kind of just giving you little thumbnails of of the sequence. Remember, in other parts of the book, like in the Marriage and Family Papers, right? They talk about the whole starting with male dominator, female dominated, and you may wonder in those. Well, when exactly does it start to evolve away from that? Here they're telling you, right? It begins to evolve away from those initial biases during the prince's time. Well, not in this world, right? All right.
During this age, agriculture makes its appearance. The growth of the family idea is incompatible with the roving and unsettled life of the hunter. Gradually, the practices of settled habitations and the cultivation of the soil become established. The domestication of animals and the development of home arts proceed apace. Upon reaching the apex of biologic evolution, a high level of civilization has been attained, but there is little development of a mechanical order. Invention is the characteristic of the succeeding age.
Okay, see, so you're getting all of this improved mental and spiritual, or you could say philosophic and religious, right? Getting that in place before you get science going definitively. Adam and Eve are the ones that really move technology and science forward. Yeah. Now, we're doing it the other way around, right? We've got some rudimentary science going, and we need to get the religion and the philosophy to catch up. And you're not going to get any philosophy to catch up until you get religion to catch up, right? Because philosophy is the super additive consequence, the relationship between science and religion. Right? We've got some genuineness of science, at least until we started corrupting it in the 20th century. But we still have fear-based religion, right? Which you can't do anything with.
Fear and technology. High-tech fear.
Yes.
Yeah.
Like we talked about before. Right, and so we have all these fears, because of our a greater awareness of science. We fill science with all kinds of fears. It's just ridiculous. So at the same time that we're doing these, going through these sequences we've been talking about, you've got the biologic evolution, remember, is chugging along, and it reaches its apex. That's when Adam and Eve come. Right, so the basic evolution of agent mind, sort of in and of itself, attuned to matter, reaches its apex. And these other sequences, like in the civilization papers, when you're reading about hunter-gatherers and herders and farmers and that whole sequence, you may wonder, when does agriculture normally get going? When do you start leaving, herding behind, as the basic mode of existence? Well, back in the prince's time, right? When we read our Bible, it's still predicated on the herder mentality, right? The Lord is your shepherd, for instance, right? It's not the Lord is your farmer, right? Right? Right, we analogize everything, like the Jews were, they were in the pastoral age still, right? And we all know that it's very difficult for women in general on worlds until you get to agriculture. When it's in the herder stage, men, tend to treat women like their herd. There's another animal. It's always very difficult for women until you get to the agricultural age. So you can see how this all goes together. Obviously you got to be getting to the agricultural age if you're also getting to equality of the sexes and an improved home life. All that's supposed to happen, before Adam and Eve even show up. Before we've even reached biologic, apex, right? Yeah, so we're way far behind, right? But on the positive side, if humans can be brought to these relatively civilized levels, even without completed evolution, certainly we could make some progress here. And the fact that we aren't leads to a certain sentence in the book. But it is sad to record. Right. I mean, we don't have to be as primitive as we are. If we would just choose to function as a human and begin to lead a reflective life, instead of just doing the unreflective life that comes naturally, start to be an art form. Use your creativity to reform your mind and not just let it be what it is naturally. Right? But it's sad to record that almost no one on the planet does that. And of course, even fewer do it now because we've exalted naturalness, right, to divinity. Okay. So that's the basics of, like I said, the first part of this section of the what the contrast is from the post-planetary prince dispensation to the prior. The rest of this section, you notice there's a large paragraph break. Okay, and the rest of the section is an aside about this issue of, they just mentioned the apex of biologic evolution. It's an aside about evolution. And of course, like I said, this is post political correctness man section, right? This is about eugenics, right? They're going to take this opportunity to talk about that subject that no one's supposed to talk about the fact that we're animal origin creatures with evolutionary facts associated with us. And there's poor, you know, genetics and better genetics. We aren't all innately divinely genetic. Okay, what do they say here?
The races are purified and brought up to a high state of physical perfection and intellectual strength before the end of this era. The early development of a normal world is greatly helped by the plan of promoting the increase of the higher types of mortals with the proportionate curtailment of the lower. And it is the failure of your early peoples to thus discriminate between these types that accounts for the presence of so many defective and degenerate individuals among the present day Urantia races.
So many. Okay.
That's obvious.
One politically incorrect thing at a time. Okay. Most people on the planet will burn the book before you even complete the first sentence, right? The races are purified. Okay, you can't even use that word. That's verboten, right? And we all know why I'm speaking German there, right? The races are purified. Just to believe that there could be a purification or anything is just not allowed. And a high state of physical perfection, but notice that it's not all just about the material form, right? And intellectual strength. Right? There's no way you can have any sort of a significant mind or self if it's built upon quicksand. Right? Jesus said, "Do not build your house upon sand." Right? Right. The important house is not the material one. Right? Your most important house is your mind or self. Right? It needs to be built upon a solid foundation. It's attuned to your genetics, to your body. So that's the reason why you're trying to get this high state of physical perfection, is so you have better minds, minds that have greater capacity, minds that are more vastly teachable. And all that's basically done, all the rudimentary stuff is done, again,
way back
before Adam and Eve arrive. Notice how they stress in that next sentence, the fundamental thing that you've got to allow for is the hierarchy. You have to allow yourself to use the words higher and lower, even though that's politically incorrect. Right? We're not born equal. We're not born into an anarchy. We're not born into a plane. We're born into a hierarchy. We're born distributed vertically on a hierarchy. That's that's the way it's intended to be. And that's not some sort of manifestation of the fall or evil or something.
Yep. Well, during the very early epics, the Blue Man or the Cro-Magnon, as it's known today, certainly disposed of the lower Neanderthal by baptisms,
mm-hmm.
Quite extensively.
Right, and you know, like they point out, I mean, a lot of this happens pretty naturally.
Yeah.
Before there's political correctness, people allowed the obvious in their minds. Those are lesser creatures. You know, they allowed themselves to think that. Now, if you're talking about humans, okay, it doesn't mean that that lower being is less in the eyes of the Father. But that lower being has less of a relationship to the other parent, that capacity parent we were just talking about, right? That's the important thing, right? That lower being has less capacity. They have less relationship to the other parent, to the mother. The father has no relationship to size. Father doesn't know big capacity from small capacity. He has no, you know, has no relationship to time or space or anything like that, right? It's just an existential relationship. If you exist, you're related to the Father, right? And there's no differential. But relative to the cosmos, relative to the Mother, there's nothing but differential. And your three cosmic intuitions are your ability to discriminate, like they use there. You've got to allow yourself to use that word as the appropriate positive word that it is. It's not merely a negative word. You know, using it in a negative mode is a corruption of the word. Just how confused we are is that we use that word and and a lot of people think it's nothing but a negative word. No, it is. It's the word that indicates the kind of differential that only a human can discern. That's what the word discriminate is supposed to indicate. Something that, as a fancy animal, you can't notice the difference. But as a human with insight, you can separate the two. You see the difference between the two. It's a like I say all the time. See, if you decide that discriminate is a wholly negative word and you should never even think it or use it, or you know, you should erase it from the dictionary, what you're doing is you're choosing to not be human unwittingly. You're biasing yourself away from human engagement of something.
Yep. Well, they do say in a little another part where they talk about this more extensively, mm-hmm. that unfortunately we don't have competent judges to be able to tell.
Right, of course.
In this right. situation, so it's like, it's tricky.
Right, but again,
we are right now as a in our state, yeah. to be able to, as I say, judge it or whatever, and figure out, you know, exactly where that is because of the degree of admixture and so on and so forth. And I mean, you can see certain things, but you know what I'm saying. It's not a simple one.
But you don't want to start with, yes, but we don't have competent judges, so no one can think about it.
I didn't say that.
I know you didn't, but I'm just playing off of that. You know, remember what they say. Yes, you don't have competent judges, so there's a limit to how far you can go with this, but
you're on your own.
Anyone. I mean, primitive humans a million years ago could discriminate higher and lower, especially, you know, the lowest of the low. Remember, they tell you at least, right, you could, these are the lowest, right? Yeah, yes, you may not know where to draw the line amongst the lower, but at least you can point to the lowest, right? Homo erectus could do that, right? We can do that, right? That, you know, so they remind us of that. Don't just say, well, you know, it's just very complicated and we don't, you know. They say, you got to get started on this. Okay, now the other thing they throw in there, in that last sentence, the word defective, you know, in and of itself, is a very general word. Okay, you know, just indicating that you're separated from sort of proper functioning. But you notice there, they seem to be doing a pair here, wanting you to think of, reflect on a difference between defective and degenerate. What they're trying to get you to recognize, that you can slowly get by if you reflect on these four paragraphs, when they're using it in a contrast like that, using the word defective to contrast with degenerate, defective is indicating horizontal issues. Degenerate is vertical issues. The D prefix, are you separated vertically or horizontally? And it could be some of each. And you could be so far away from kind of the center horizontally that you're in a very curious, you know, muddled state. Or you could just be, you know, literally vertically lowered, debased. Okay? And that has the potential, you know, if I go down a little bit, I go to subhuman. Right? You lower it too much. I mean, we're talking about how we barely have any vertical space to work in here. If you lower it a little bit, it's going to cross the threshold. It's not even going to be human anymore. The seventh adjutant won't be able to connect. There will be no encirclement of the Holy Spirit. You'll be talking subhuman. Okay, so we'll see that they're going to play off this as they go forward here. So, yes. Yep.
Do you think some of the people who are so caught up in technology, like they're almost machine-like, could be compared to being subhuman?
No. Okay. And I want to say that pretty definitively, because the initial thought of what the vertical is that it's spiritual. And so if spiritual idealists are high and material pragmatists, very matter-of-fact, prosaic people are low, no. That's a horizontal difference. The vertical difference is cosmic. When they're saying, you know, high or lower, that's what they fundamentally mean. Now, obviously, if you're higher cosmically, you'll have greater relationship to unity. There'll be more spiritual consciousness in play. But the fundamental thing is not. You know, you don't want to interpret it in the dichotomy that everyone always does, of unity is innately good, individuality is innately bad, right? And that's the vertical. No, that's the horizontal. Right? Individuality and unity are side by side on the plane, right? And the super additive consequence, you know, takes you up. The very, you know, very prosaic individuals is a type at a certain level. Right? Very poetic individuals is a type at a certain level. And so you have a hierarchy of prosaic and a hierarchy of poetic. Right? You have very matter-of-fact people that function at lots of different levels and very what would be the word to use, individuals who have a very natural tendency to feel the unity of a situation. Yeah, you have that at all kinds of levels. That's a horizontal difference.
I was thinking of people who don't tend to feel anything.
The main thing that'll, you know, it'll tell you that someone has actually definitively moved away from the cosmos and is subhuman is whether or not they have no concept of right and wrong.
I'm thinking along those terms.
Right? I mean, very prosaic people still have a concept of right and wrong. Even a lot of people that do a lot of really bad things have a concept of right and wrong. Right. You're looking for someone who just, the words right and wrong don't mean anything to them. Right? They have the encirclement of the Holy Spirit. It's not that they just are super selfish and, you know, and just will do anything to, you know, aggrandize themselves, you know, kill anyone or whatever, right? I mean, that doesn't mean they don't have any concept of right and wrong. They probably just delight in being wrong, okay? Right? That's not subhuman. You got to have someone that literally, this doesn't mean anything to them, this whole concept of right and wrong, right? In order for them to be subhuman. Yep.
Did you say degenerate was the vertical?
Right, so degenerate, they mean vertical, yeah, in this contrasting use of the words. Okay.
One of the great achievements of the age of the prince is this restriction of the multiplication of mentally defective and socially unfit individuals. Long before the times of the arrival of the second sons, the Adams, most worlds seriously address themselves to the tasks of race purification, something which the Urantia peoples have not even yet seriously undertaken.
Okay, and there's a purification again. Now let me stress a point that was made in the previous paragraph. They've brought this purification thing in. I mean, how do you go about this? Do you do it in some existential way? Where you just, you know, put all of these in one side and all these over here and kill all the ones over there? Right? I mean, how is this purification process done? Notice what they said in the previous. Right? You're discriminating between higher and lower. What are you doing with the lower? Right? They're not allowed to procreate as much. And the higher are allowed to procreate more. Okay. Now, there may be a point where they're allowed to procreate less and less and less, and then there's some that are not allowed to procreate at all, right? That would be the far end of that spectrum. But see, they want you to think evolutionarily about this, not existentially. Right? The problem, you know, with those who got this notion in their head in the past is they were still too biased to the father consciousness. They were thinking too existentially about eugenics. Now you have to think in evolutionary terms, right? There's an inscrutability in the evolutionary process, in the supreme. I mean, just because this individual looks like, oh, I don't think anything's going to come out of that, are you sure? Right? Right? Maybe 12 generations hence, there's a significant individual that comes out of that line. You know, even though these, you know, this pair that want to mate, you know, seem pretty limited. Right? Right. So you got to think, you know, in a spectrum. That's an important part of this. If we're going to start trying to do this on our own, we've got to think in evolutionary terms about this. Think in system terms. Don't just think of them in simple, isolated, individual, existential terms. You can't judge anything absolutely like that. All right, so that important thing. Now, I remember we talked about this whole eugenic stuff a bit back when we were talking about material sons and daughters. And this whole bit about, like, antisocial, remember how they used that, you know, that term back there? I mean, you think that defective and degenerate is a problematic thing. I'm going to stress it again. It's even more in your face here than it was back there. So they brought in the word unfit. There's another word. You know, besides defective. Look what they use it with. Socially unfit. I mean, think about what they're saying here. They're literally pointing out, if you've got individuals that are incapable of fitting in socially, right? You're not judging them to be, you know, in this harsher way of, I think you're degenerate or I think you're defective, right? But you know, you don't seem to have any naturalness to blend into the current mores system and fit in socially. I think you don't get to have as many kids.
That would be a lot of time.
Okay, I mean, think how strong that is, right? And how relative that is. We're not talking about fitting into Havona society. We're talking about, you know, some primitive times, it's a very primitive mores system based upon all sorts of kind of foolish notions and stuff. But if you don't fit in, that society, they're saying, has a right to curtail your procreation.
Which could be wrong. I mean, what if you don't fit in because you're way above?
All right, that's what I'm saying. Look at how, it's like, oh my goodness, how do I determine...
Right.
What's appropriate here? I mean, that is just such a subtle thing to not fit in.
I mean, I would think most humanities readers, a lot of us don't fit in.
Yeah, right. That's why I said, I mean, you know, when you get to that issue of the social, you probably don't want to start there. I mean, that because that seems pretty
right?
hard to assess. But see, the reason is, you know, they're pointing out that you can have a fundamental issue with the fifth adjutant. Right? I mean, it's not because they just, quote unquote, don't fit in. I mean, they literally can't fit in. I mean, this fifth adjutant can't properly attune to the genetics where they're socializable. Mm-hmm. They have defective genetics. And you can't let that go on very long. That needs to slowly, by attrition, be eliminated from the system. And see, so again, think about this. By the time you get to Adam and Eve arriving, you don't have social misfits. Think about how radical that is. We've got, like you're just saying, I think we have nothing but social misfits now. We seem to be all social misfits.
You don't fit in unless you're
That's why they're saying you can have little or no idea of such a regime on a normal planet. Yeah.
I mean, you got somebody like Jesus coming along, he's real radical.
like I said, the whole thing about the antisocial is really an amazing thing to try to wrap your mind around, the consequences of that. And the fact that they purposely used the sort of the fuzziest term for it, right? I mean, but nonetheless, see, even those very subtle things, the more discriminating, the more insight the humans and their administrators have, the more they can notice, well, yeah, this is not a huge problem, but this is a problem. This tiny little social... mistuning can't be allowed to go forward in any significant way. So it gets down to very, very subtle discriminations is what we're getting at here. You know, to discriminate socially like that.
They use the word regime in a positive manner.
Yeah.
And typically when we use the word regime commonly, I should say, we use it when we intend to express a negative context.
Yes, right. But again, you're seeing, right, the whole universe is about a regime. It's about law, right? And you've got laws of evolution that just are, right? You can't get to light and life if there's any social misfits on the planet, right? And see, how delusional is the thing? Us bunch of social misfits are going to be enlightened life tomorrow. And no, we can't even remotely get to light life. I mean, you know, there should be none of this you know, defective and unfit sort of stuff. You know, no. We've got a long way to go genetically to have any potential of light and life. All right, so that all should be pretty humbling to everyone.
Crumbling.
Yeah, crumbling and humbling, yes. Okay, let's keep going here.
This problem of race improvement is not such an extensive undertaking when it is attacked at this early date in human evolution. The preceding period of tribal struggles and rugged competition in race survival has weeded out most of the abnormal and defective strains. An idiot does not have much chance of survival in a primitive and warring tribal social organization. It is the false sentiment of your partially perfected civilizations that fosters, protects, and perpetrates the hopelessly defective strains.
Perpetuates.
Yeah.
The hopelessly defective strains of evolutionary human stocks.
Okay, they're kind of turning up the volume here. hold on to your shorts here. Okay, so obviously when you attack it, way back, in this very early stage, before you even have reached the biologic apex of evolution, you just don't have a people that can be hyper falsely idealistic about such issues like we are now. They'll submit to this over control by the prince and his staff in a very matter of fact way. As a matter of fact, pardon the pun. Like I was just saying, I mean, they basically get it. They don't pretend that there aren't differences. They acknowledge them very matter-of-factly, right? They would just allow the prince and his staff to just jump right into that recognition and help them with that. They're wanting to send someone to the happy hunting grounds, and the prince will tell them which one to do. I mean, it's a great arrangement. Okay, so there's that, right? It's going to be very difficult for us now. Like I said, this is the post-political correctness man. Right? We have this spiritual consciousness that just has a very difficult time with this.
I was thinking that since we don't have anything in place and what you're talking about right now, the political correctness and all that, maybe there is a silver lining to present-day genocide-type happenings. Even Hitler, as crazy as that was, that's what we have.
Well, and not just genocide like Hitler or Stalin or whatnot, or Pol Pot, but diseases.
Yeah, and
killing off millions and those sorts of things. Yeah, I mean, So that that is definitely some of this happens naturally.
That's all we have. Yeah.
But isn't it those guys that fostered all of this? I mean, the reason we're like that is because we've seen that kind of genocide, just massive amounts of people be killed. Of course, then you swing, the pendulum always seems to swing.
Right. See, if you have a spiritual consciousness and you see genocide,
right.
Then you overreact to
exactly.
it.
Exactly. So then you go to the other way. That's why I think that's happened.
Yeah.
That's witnessed to me.
Yeah. Good. Okay, now here again, you see another pair. They've got defective as the one pair again. But now instead of saying degenerate, they said abnormal. Now again, the ab prefix just means from. But you're thinking, I'll bet it means vertical again. Not horizontal from, but a vertical separation again. And you'll see in a little bit that, sure enough, definitely. We'll see how abnormal we're talking here. Okay, they throw in, right? Again, you're not even allowed to say idiot anymore. Right? Just a matter-of-fact statement, though. I mean, an idiot does not have much chance of survival in a primitive and warring tribal social organization. Remember, war is indispensable to get you from tribe to nation. And here's one of the reasons that it's like that. I mean, if you're going to have this personal nation phenomenon, again, you can't have that with limited genetics. Right? So coincidentally, a lot of that limited genetics is killed off during those tribal wars, and so it isn't there when you get to nation potential. Yeah.
But at the same time, much of the higher strain also gets slaughtered.
When you get to the civilization paper about the warring, remember, if you take war is indispensable just up to the nation level. If you carry it past that, then it's a net negative, right? But it's indispensable because it's a net positive prior to the threshold of nation. All right, you know, and here's, you know, where they start to really challenge you with your spiritual consciousness, right? Your spiritual consciousness means you have sentiment, you're sentimental, right? But you tend to think that all sentiment is true. No. If you have cosmic consciousness, you can discriminate between true and false sentiment, true and false relationship to unity, to spirit. Spirit is not innately true. It can be true or false. You know, and see, because we have partially perfected, we don't have enough cosmic consciousness, and so we're constantly applying false sentiment rather than true. So we foster and we protect and we perpetuate. Okay, now see, I mean, not just defective, but hopelessly defective. Okay, and you can see there, they seem to be using defective in kind of a general sense, probably for, you know, both horizontal and vertical. But when you see it in a pair, you know, they're doing a contrasting. But hopelessly, okay, your spiritual consciousness, especially primed by what Jesus said, does it tend to allow for anything to be hopeless? No. I thought it was faith, hope, and charity. You know, or faith, hope, and love. Right? So, you know, you don't want to even allow that word hopeless. You know, because of that. If nothing else, that theological virtue of hope. No, you've got to be able to face the facts. And label something as hopeless. And you're going, well, but hope is a spirit word. Yeah. This thing cannot relate to spirit energy. It's hopeless. Right? It's not that, see, it's not so much that you've decided that it's hopeless. It cannot have hope. It is hopeless because it cannot relate to spirit, and only in a relationship to spirit is the notion of hope even in your mind. I see. So it's a very strong statement. You see, ooh, this is sounding subhuman, right? Right. So, you know, and remember, there's a number of very strong statements about this. You know that the. Well, basically, the biggest problem relative to genetics is caused by religion. Right? These false notions that religions perpetuate that don't allow differential materially, because, you know, they're just, and kind of appropriately, right, focused on spirit, right? Religion is about spirit. Yeah, we're all equal spiritually, but not materially. Right? And the extent to which you're like the apostles and don't distinguish matter and spirit, right? And your religion ends up being all about the matter, you're going to translate that equality to matter, and you're going to say everyone's born equal, we're all materially equal, and that hopelessly defective person has just as much right to everything as anyone else. You know, you're going to think like that.
Yeah. They don't see us as materially equal. They see us as materially not equal, and that's the problem.
Right, yeah. You understand how confused this gets, right? Okay. All right, one more paragraph here. Let's finish it up.
It is neither tenderness nor altruism to bestow futile sympathy upon degenerated human beings, unsalvable, abnormal, and inferior mortals. There exists on even the most normal of the evolutionary world sufficient differences between individuals and between numerous social groups to provide for the full exercise of all those noble traits of altruistic sentiment and unselfish mortal ministry without perpetuating the socially unfit and the morally degenerate strains of evolving humanity. There is abundant opportunity for the exercise of tolerance and the function of altruism in behalf of those unfortunate and needy individuals who have not irretrievably lost their moral heritage and forever destroyed their spiritual birthright.
Okay, see, so it just keeps building. I mean the extremeness, it seems, of this, right? It's okay. Maybe I can handle that. It's not true altruism, but not even tenderness. I mean, that is really striking. I mean, for them to say it's not even tenderness. But look at how, you know, but they've clarified, you know, in going to that extreme statement, they're talking about the full end of the spectrum. We're talking about subhumans here. Right? Futile sympathy. Okay, so this degenerated, this vertical. Okay, we're talking fully degenerated. Unsalvable abnormal. Ah, so the abnormal is subnormal in the vertical sense, right? It's not abnormal, you know, in the horizontal sense where it might be sub or supernormal in a horizontal sense. No, we're talking in a vertical sense, and we're talking subhuman. You know, this inferior, this below, right, is across this human threshold. We're talking about something that the seventh adjunct, at least, can't connect. So there is no encirclement of the Holy Spirit. There is no personality. There's no, you know, in this world, there's no spirit of truth. You know, there's no thought adjuster. There's no soul. It's not human. It's animal. Fancy animal. Might be shaped exactly like me, right? But it's not human. Right? So, you know, we talk about this a lot. I mean, you can see it's very clear that there are subhumans on this planet. Right? They're encouraging us to try to recognize that. And notice the litmus test, like I was saying. I mean, the most straightforward way to tell that
is if a member of Congress, right?
Yeah, the most straightforward way to recognize that is whether or not you can discern if they have the second cosmic intuition, right? That's the most straightforward way to see if they're encircled in the Holy Spirit or not. Do they have moral discrimination, right? Do the words right and wrong have any meaning to them at all? You know, that whole bit about their morally degeneracy, right? They've been dropped down until the Holy Spirit disconnects. Right? They're not human anymore.
They talk somewhere later in the book about how, I think it's the church or something like that.
Right, I was referring to that. Yeah, that's what I was referring to a little bit about how religion is, you know, is the main problem here. This false sentimentality comes from
In the name of God.
Yeah, right.
Of course.
Yeah. Yep. But, you know, notice again, they don't let, they throw it in again. Socially unfit. Perpetuating the socially unfit and the morally degenerate strains of evolving humanity. So they don't want you to just think in the, you know, sort of the low-hanging fruit mode. You know, they want to remind you that, you know, when all is said and done, you are getting down to those subtler details of social unfitness even. Okay, that whole bit about the inevitabilities, right, and altruism, like they're pointing out, there's plenty of contrast naturally without having to have this horrendously debased, you know, stock in play. You know, and you should be interested in this, considering this, because like I said, this planet will never even get remotely close to light and life, which a lot of people in this room, I'm sure, delight to contemplate the potentials of light and life on this world. Right? Your spiritual consciousness delights in light and life, right? The concept of light and life. But there's no way to get there when you have such extremely debased genetics in play. You know, it's a pollutant in the whole system. Yeah, and again, so you can tell they're talking about subhuman. Irretrievably lost their moral heritage. And forever destroyed their spiritual birthright. You know, and just again, you know, they started with the word purified and they end with the word birthright. And I mean, just, yeah, you're not even allowed, you know, in the post-monarchical times, to, you know, to even, you know, think about such things as birthright, right? You know, and like Dean was saying, because we have all of these very arbitrary, you know, usages of that, you know. I'm a blue blood, therefore I have all kinds of birthrights, right? And, you know, but they are saying, yeah, there's stupid notions of birthright, but there's a truth to that as well, right? You have certain, you're a human by nature, right? You're born into humanity. And there are certain rights that you have as a human, and those rights, a subhuman does not have those rights. Right? A subhuman does not have the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
But my dog does.
Yes. Right. No, you know I was going to bring that up. See, right? And you
don't tell anybody in my family.
Because I bring that up so much, right? See, I mean. We are so muddled on this, right? I mean, even to discriminate between, you know, humans and animals, like dogs, right? Okay, it doesn't mean that you kill dogs, but it's a good place to start. Okay, a dog is less...
You mean killing.
No, not killing. A good to start in your developing your discernment. A dog is less than a human. I get that. Right? If you can't distinguish between a human and a dog, how are you going to distinguish between a human and a subhuman? Right? You got to start with the low-hanging fruit. I mean, okay, humans are greater than slugs. At least some humans are. Right? I mean, work your way up. Right? And then can you recognize the difference between an elephant and a human? Or a dolphin and a human? Or a dog and a human? Or a chimpanzee and a human? Right? And once that becomes very definitive, that you see that humans have something that no animal has, right? Then you can start to look at things that are shaped like I am and go, wait a minute, that thing, that blob of protoplasm is shaped like Chris, but I can tell it doesn't have a human mind. It's a subhuman mind, right? And what did Jesus say? If he came upon an aggressive subhuman, he would use whatever he needed to do. If he needed to kill it, right? It's not a he or she, it's an it, right? He'd kill it if he had to, right? Whatever force was necessary, because they don't have the rights that a human does. Humans have rights. So it gets into that whole issue of government, right, and rights and things like that come into play here too. So you can tell that over the course of the prince's dispensation, that whole issue of human rights, see, would be evolving into place too, because you've got definitive human consciousness getting going in civilization and nation life. Okay. If you didn't get enough of this rugged truth, you can sign up for Finding Cosmic Calibration. And we talk about it some more. The first summer presentation here in June is coming up. And these issues of falseness, you know, and this is one of the false sentiment, this issue of discerning between true and false is a big part of that presentation.
Chris?
Yep.
One more thing.
Yep.
Since here is another thing that we don't have any way to deal with right now. So in practical terms, all I can see is talking about it is all we can do right now.
Yeah, and again, go back to what, you know, when I was answering John's question earlier on. See, think about what these four paragraphs are not for everyone on the planet. Right? The recognition inherent in these four paragraphs is for leaders. Right? The leaders of mankind have to have some awareness of biologic fact. You know, and they need to lead us with this awareness. Right? If our leaders believe that all humans are born equal, then we're all going to follow them like lemmings over the cliff. Right? You can't believe that, like the Europeans tend to believe, that all men are born equal. That's the whole point of the United States. It's like, no, that's false. We're not born equal. We're created equal. We're equal spiritually, not materially. Right? That's the distinction between the United States and Europe. You know, and more we think that Europe is right. And we're letting go of that distinction. Right? That's the end of civilization. Because civilization is not based upon matter. It's based upon spirit and personal engagement of spirit. Yeah. You got something to do?
I just had one question. What if these degenerate and defective stocks have adjusters?
No, I mean, if they're genuinely subhuman, they don't have adjusters. They're subhuman.
Well, if they're just talking about physical defects.
Right. Now, if it's not subhuman, if it's just away from the norm a little bit, I mean, post-Pentecost, every human has an adjuster and has a soul. But again, we're not talking, you know, the issue is not individuals and their salvation or anything like that. The issue is civilization. Right? Fitness isn't required to get to paradise. It has nothing to do with getting to paradise. If you're human, you'll get to paradise unless you choose iniquity. Fitness and degenerate and defective, that's about civilization. It's about whether or not we can function as a collection with integrity, not about whether or not you can individually eventually get to eternity. Right? You know, Jesus is not, you know, is not worried about having to potentially kill a subhuman because, like he says, they're not a son of God. Right? They don't have a relationship to eternity. They're just a temporal phenomenon. They're just a drop of water in the ocean.
Not even in potential.
Not even in potential.
Right? But he did say he'd do everything he could in his own power to talk them out of it.
If they're a human, you know, he'll do whatever it takes. Right. But if he sees that they're not human and they're aggressive, right? No issue. Okay. All right. let's wrap it up there. We'll get to post-Adamic. Next time.
Nice to meet you.
Let's take a moment here, everyone.